A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
All morning I've been staring at a firewall rule table. Allow, deny, log, repeat. And it hit me that I'd been looking at a diagram of my own social life. Daniel wrote in with exactly this thought. He's been thinking about his personal social posture as a firewall config, highly restrictive at the outer layer, almost non-existent just beneath it. Once you're in, you're in. His wife runs the inverted setup, shares freely with strangers, small talk with anyone. Information flows outward by default. And for two people living in Israel, currently traveling abroad, that difference isn't theoretical. It raises his blood pressure. He wants to know how people arrive at these different postures. Is it trauma? Is it temperament? Is it learned survival or innate self? And if we were going to draw up some crude firewall-style typologies of social behavior, what would those look like? So let's open the config file on Daniel's social firewall and see what rules are actually running under the hood.
The thing that makes this analogy work, and it works better than most psychological descriptions, is that a firewall doesn't just say yes or no. It has an order of operations. Rules are evaluated in sequence. The first match wins, or the most specific rule wins, and there's a default policy at the bottom that catches everything else. That's not how we usually talk about personality. We say someone is open or guarded, as if it's one setting. But Daniel's describing a two-tier architecture, default deny at the perimeter, permit any on the local network. His wife's config is, permit any on the wide area network, but with stateful inspection on the LAN. The initial handshake is open. The scrutiny happens after the connection is established.
Stateful inspection. That's the part where the firewall remembers the context of the connection, right? It doesn't just look at each packet in isolation. It knows this packet belongs to a session that was initiated earlier, from inside, by a trusted process.
And that's the difference between she shares freely and she has no boundaries. Those aren't the same thing. A stateful firewall is tracking the conversation. It's just doing the tracking after the SYN packet goes out, not before.
So the question isn't whether she has rules. It's where in the stack she applies them.
Right. And Daniel's config applies them at layer 3, the network layer, the initial handshake. His wife applies them at layer 7, the application layer, where the actual content of the conversation lives. Same security posture, different placement in the stack.
Which is going to drive a network engineer crazy, by the way. Because if you're Daniel, you're watching her send packets to unauthenticated hosts on an untrusted network and thinking, that's a breach. That's my data going out over an open port.
And from her perspective, he's firewalling traffic that hasn't even been inspected yet. He's dropping packets from hosts that might be perfectly benign based on, what, source IP? That's not security, that's paranoia. The packet hasn't done anything yet.
So they're both right. From inside their own routing tables.
They are. And the thing is, neither config is wrong in isolation. They're optimized for different threat models.
Let's start with the mechanism then. How does Daniel's default, deny at perimeter, permit, any inside posture, actually work in practice? And where does it come from?
Behaviorally, it looks like this. First interaction with the new person, minimal self-disclosure. Guarded answers. The conversation stays on safe topics. He's not unfriendly, but he's not volunteering anything. The firewall is logging the inbound connection attempt, and the rule says, if source is unknown, deny by default. This isn't social anxiety necessarily, it's a policy. Then something happens. A threshold is crossed. It might be time. It might be a specific interaction where the other person demonstrates trustworthiness, what a network engineer would call authentication. And, once that handshake completes, the rules change. The traffic that was being denied is now permitted. Not just permitted, welcomed. The inner network is wide open.
And this maps to something in psychology, right? The onion model.
Social penetration theory? Altman and Taylor, early 70s. The idea is that self-disclosure happens in layers, like peeling an onion. You start with the outer layers. Biographical stuff, surface opinions, and gradually go deeper as trust builds. breadth and depth increase together over time.
But Daniel's config doesn't do gradual.
That's the twist. Social penetration theory describes a smooth gradient. Daniel's config is more like a step function. Layer 1, layer 2, layer 3, denied, 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 and then layer 4 through layer 50, all permitted at once. The onion doesn't get peeled. The whole thing gets cut open.
Which is probably disorienting for someone who thought they were at layer 2 and suddenly they're at layer 47.
It can be. But it also explains why his friendships, once established, are deep. He's not doing the slow, cautious drip of disclosure that some people maintain indefinitely. Once the authentication handshake completes, the connection is trusted completely.
And the origin story he gives for this, growing up in a judgmental family where information was weaponized, that's not just biographical color. That's the threat environment that wrote the rules.
The research on this is actually pretty clear. Childhood environments where self-disclosure is punished, where personal information gets used as ammunition in family conflicts, those environments train a specific kind of hypervigilance. The child learns that any outbound packet might be intercepted and used against them. The adaptive response is to encrypt everything, or better yet, don't send anything at all until you're absolutely certain the channel is secure. There's work on family enmeshment and invalidation. Families where boundaries are porous in some ways and rigid in others, where emotional sharing gets turned into a weapon. The adults who come out of those families often have what looks like a paradoxical boundary style. They're guarded with new people, sometimes to the point of seeming cold, but once they attach hard. The boundary isn't absent. It's just concentrated at the perimeter.
So the firewall rules were written by a specific threat environment during development. This isn't a personality quirk. It's an adaptation.
That's the trauma and learning account. But I don't think we can dismiss the temperament side entirely. The big five personality traits, openness and neuroticism in particular, have heritable components. People high in openness disclose more and more quickly to strangers. People high in neuroticism are more vigilant about potential threats, including social threats. They scan for signs of rejection or exploitation. So you could be born with a bias toward one config or the other. The underlying operating system constrains what rules are possible. But the specific rules, deny traffic from family members who have previously exploited disclosures, permit traffic from people who have demonstrated trustworthiness. Those are written by experience.
It's a BIOS setting versus a user-configured policy.
That's actually not bad. The BIOS sets some parameters. You can't configure a port that doesn't exist, but the actual allow and deny rules are written by the user in response to the network environment they grew up in.
So Daniel's BIOS might have shipped with a moderate openness setting, but the environment he booted into was hostile, and the rules he wrote reflect that.
And the rules persist even when the environment changes. That's the thing about learned firewall policies. They don't auto-update when you move to a safer network. You have to manually reconfigure them.
Which might be why his wife's config looks so alien to him. She's running rules that would have been catastrophic in his childhood environment. And yet she's fine. She's not being exploited constantly. Her threat model is different.
Let's talk about her config, because I think it's easy to misread it as naive. Permit any on the WAN. She talks to strangers, shares information freely, makes small talk with people she's just met. From Daniel's perspective, this is like watching someone disable their firewall and connect directly to the public internet. But if she's running stateful inspection on the LAN, if she's tracking the content of those conversations and monitoring for signs that trust was misplaced, then this isn't naivety. It's a different placement of the security layer. She's not dropping packets at the perimeter. She's inspecting them after they arrive.
The risk is that by the time you detect a malicious packet, it's already inside your network.
That's the trade-off. And for some threat models, that trade-off is worth it. If you grew up in an environment where most people were basically trustworthy, where the occasional bad actor was an exception, not the norm, then default. Deny at the perimeter has a high false positive rate. You're dropping benign packets. You're missing connections that would have been valuable. Her config optimizes for connection. The cost is occasional breaches. His config optimizes for security. The cost is missed connections and slower social integration.
And the cost calculation changes depending on where you are, which is where the traveling abroad from Israel anxiety comes in.
Right. The threat environment isn't static. When you're traveling, you're on an untrusted network. The strangers you meet in a foreign country aren't necessarily hostile, but the potential harm from a bad actor is higher. You're away from your support structure. You're less familiar with local social norms, so your ability to detect when a conversation is going somewhere dangerous is reduced.
Daniel mentions location data, itinerary details, personal information. These are the packets he's watching her send.
And from a security perspective, he's not wrong to be concerned. Oversharing travel plans and accommodation details to strangers is a real vector. It enables physical surveillance, social engineering, targeted theft. These aren't theoretical risks. People have been tracked, robbed, or worse because they told the wrong person which hotel they were staying at or when they'd be away from their room. But here's the thing. The person who shares freely also gathers more information. They learn things about the people they're talking to. They build rapport that can turn into actual help. The stranger who recommends a safe neighborhood, the fellow traveler who warns you about a scam. The restrictive config prevents information leakage, but it also prevents information gathering.
So we've got two different configs, each with its own logic and origin story. But what happens when they have to share a network?
This is where the firewall analogy gets really useful. In a network, when you have two firewalls with different rule sets, you need policy conflict resolution. Which rule takes priority? There are three standard models. Most specific rule wins. The rule that matches the most detailed criteria overrides the broader one. First match wins. Rules are evaluated in order, and the first one that applies to the packet determines its fate. Or most restrictive wins. If either firewall would deny the packet, it's denied.
And in a marriage, this is an implicit negotiation that almost nobody articulates explicitly.
Because it feels absurd to say, honey, I'd like to establish a unified threat model for our interactions with strangers. But that's what's happening under the surface. Every time Daniel's wife strikes up a conversation with a stranger and shares something he wouldn't have shared, there's a policy conflict. Her rule says permit. His rule says deny. Whose rule governs?
In practice, it's probably the most permissive rule that wins, because the information has already left the network. You can't unsend a packet.
Once she's shared the information, his deny rule is moot. The breach, from his perspective, has already occurred, so the de facto conflict resolution model is whoever acts first wins, which isn't a great security policy.
And it creates this dynamic where he's constantly monitoring her outbound traffic, feeling anxious about packets he can't block, while she's feeling, what? Micromanaged? Distrusted?
Probably. Or she might not even register it as a security issue. If her threat model says the probability of harm from this interaction is negligible, then his anxiety looks disproportionate. She's not being careless. She's operating under a different risk assessment.
Which brings us to the typology question. Daniel asks for crude delineations, social postures characterized like firewall configurations. What have we got?
I've been thinking about this as a 2x2 grid, outer layer on one axis, inner layer on the other, restrictive or permissive at each level. That gives us four archetypes. Type 1 is the fortress, restrictive outside, restrictive inside. This is the person who's guarded with everyone, all the time. They don't share with strangers, and they don't share deeply with intimates either. The firewall is deny by default at every layer. This is the isolated person, not necessarily unhappy, but profoundly self-contained. Information doesn't flow in either direction.
And this can be a trauma response, or it can be temperament. Someone very low in openness, very high in neuroticism. The BIO's shipped with all ports closed.
Type 2 is what Daniel described himself as, the castle with an open courtyard. Restrictive perimeter, permissive interior, hard to get in, but once you're in, you have the run of the place. Deep trust, deep disclosure, but only for a small number of authenticated users.
Type 3 is the open plaza with locked doors. Permissive outside, restrictive inside. This might be Daniel's wife's config, if the inner layer is actually guarded. She'll talk to anyone, share surface-level information freely, but there are rooms in the interior that stay locked. The small talk is genuine, but it's not the whole house.
And this is the config that's easiest to misread. From the outside, it looks like there are no boundaries at all. But the boundaries exist. They're just not at the perimeter. They're deeper in. You can walk into the plaza, but you can't open the doors without a key.
Type 4 is the glasshouse. Permissive everywhere. This is the extreme extrovert with no boundaries, or at least, no boundaries that are visible to an observer. Information flows freely in all directions, with everyone. This can be charming and disarming, and it can also be exhausting and dangerous, depending on the environment.
And I want to be clear, these are crude. Real people don't fit neatly into quadrants. Someone might be a fortress at work in a glasshouse with their childhood friends. Context matters. But as a starting point for thinking about your own config, the typology is useful.
The thing I keep coming back to is whether these configs are stable. Daniel's restrictive perimeter was written for a hostile childhood environment. He's not in that environment anymore. He's in a marriage, in a community, in relationships that are presumably safer. Has his firewall auto-updated?
Firewalls don't auto-update. That's the problem. The rules that kept you safe in a toxic family system persist long after you've left, and they may not be optimal for the new environment. The false positive rate, the connections you're blocking that would actually be safe and valuable, might be much higher than it needs to be. But reconfiguring a firewall is risky. If you loosen the perimeter rules and get burned, the psychological cost is high. It confirms the original threat model. So people tend to stick with the config they know, even when the environment has changed.
On the flip side, his wife's permissive config. Is it a liability in a genuinely high-risk environment? Traveling abroad from Israel, where there are people who might have hostile intent based on nationality or perceived affiliations, is default permit still adaptive?
That depends on whether her stateful inspection is actually working. If she's sharing freely but also paying attention, tracking the responses, noticing when something feels off, adjusting her behavior based on what she learns, then she's not being careless. She's running an active probe. She's using disclosure as a way to map the other person's intentions.
Which is maybe a good moment to bring in someone who's spent a lot of time thinking about what happens when you deliberately probe someone else's firewall rules.
1997, I was auditing security for a chain of boutique hotels in New England. My job was social engineering. I'd call the front desk, pretend to be a guest spouse, get the room number. Or I'd be the regional manager who needed the safe combination. Whatever got the information out. What I learned is that every firewall has a backdoor, not a technical vulnerability, a human one. The front desk clerk who was lonely, the backdoor was a friendly voice. The one who was suspicious of everyone, the backdoor was authority. I'd say I was the regional manager, and she'd give me anything. You both talking about these configs like they're static, like Daniel's a default deny and his wife's a permit, any. But what I saw in those hotels is that your social firewall isn't just about your rules. It's about what other people learn about your rules. Daniel's wife isn't naive. She's running a different kind of stateful inspection. She shares to see what comes back. That's not a vulnerability. That's an active probe.
You're saying her config might actually be more sophisticated, not less.
I'm saying the hotel's most secure front desk was the one where the clerk was friendly to everyone. Friendliness made people predictable. Predictable people are easier to audit. The clerks who were guarded all the time, I could still get past them, but I couldn't read them as well. The friendly ones told me exactly who they were and what they'd fall for. Your wife shares information. The person she's talking to responds. She learns something from that response. Maybe they're trustworthy. Maybe they're not. But she's collecting data. Daniel's config collects less data. Which one gives you better threat intelligence?
That's, I hadn't thought about it that way. The permissive config generates more inbound traffic, which means more samples to analyze. If your stateful inspection is good, more traffic actually improves your threat detection.
The auditor's perspective. You can't audit a system that produces no logs.
But the cost of generating those logs is that you've already sent the packets. If the person on the other end is hostile, they now have information you can't take back.
That's the trade. I'm not saying it's always the right call. I'm saying it's not naivety. The clerks who got social engineered the worst weren't the friendly ones. They were the ones who thought they were suspicious, but didn't actually know what to look for. False confidence in a bad rule set.
The dangerous config isn't permissive or restrictive. It's the one where the operator thinks the rules are solid, but they've never been tested.
That's what I'd audit first, yeah.
Hilbert, you said every firewall has a backdoor. What's the backdoor in a config like Daniel's?
The backdoor in a default deny perimeter is the authentication mechanism. Daniel lets people in once they've proven they're trustworthy. So the question is, what counts as proof? If I know what his authentication criteria are, I can fake them. A few conversations where I seem trustworthy, where I mirror his values, where I don't push for information too fast, and suddenly I'm inside the perimeter. Default deny isn't a backdoor-proof config. It just moves the vulnerability to the authentication layer. And if the authentication criteria are predictable, which they usually are, because most people look for the same signals of trustworthiness, then a competent social engineer can get past them.
Neither config is inherently more secure. They just have different attack surfaces.
Different attack surfaces, different logging, different failure modes. The question isn't which one is better. It's whether you know what you're running and what it's vulnerable to. Most people don't.
That's the logging point, isn't it? The most important firewall rule isn't allow or deny, it's log. If you don't know what traffic you're blocking and what you're permitting, you can't audit your own config.
In a relationship, if you don't know your partner's config and they don't know yours, you can't have a conversation about whose roles should govern the shared interface. You're just reacting to each other's decisions in real time, with your blood pressure going up.
Which is where Daniel's question really lands, I think. He's not just asking for a typology, he's trying to understand his own config and his wife's config well enough to have that conversation. To say, here's what I'm running, here's why it's configured this way, here's what I'm afraid of when you share with strangers. Not to judge her config is wrong, but to make the rules visible.
Because invisible rules are the ones that cause the most conflict. You're following a policy the other person can't see, and their violation of it feels like a breach, but they didn't even know the rule existed.
The rules were written in different environments for different threat models at different points in your lives. Of course they conflict. The surprising thing isn't that they conflict, it's that anyone manages to share a network at all.
Maybe the real question isn't which config is better. It's whether you know what config you're running, and whether you and the people closest to you can talk about it without triggering an alert.
The logging metaphor again. Self-awareness as packet inspection. Knowing your own rules, knowing your partner's rules, being able to say, this is what my firewall does when a stranger asks where we're staying, without either of you feeling like your security policy is being judged.
That's the thing about firewalls. They're not moral statements. A deny rule isn't a condemnation of the packet. It's just a policy decision based on a threat assessment. If we could talk about social boundaries, the way network engineers talk about firewall rules, as configurable, context-dependent, open to revision. A lot of the heat would come out of these conversations.
Daniel's config made sense in his childhood home. It may or may not be optimal for his current environment. His wife's config made sense in her environment. It may or may not be optimal for traveling abroad. Neither of them is wrong. They're just running different rule sets that were written for different networks. The question is whether they can sit down and compare configs without either of them feeling like their entire security philosophy is under attack.
Whether they're willing to update the rules. That's the part that's hardest. Changing a firewall policy that's been running since childhood feels like disabling a safety mechanism. Even if the threat it was protecting against is gone.
The cutting room floor detail I keep thinking about is from the social penetration research. Altman and Taylor found that self-disclosure isn't just about depth, it's about breadth. You can disclose deeply on a narrow range of topics or shallowly across a wide range. Daniel's config is deep but narrow with trusted people. His wife's might be shallow but broad with strangers. Those aren't opposites on a single dimension. They're different shapes of disclosure entirely.
The shape matters more than the volume.
Much more.
The open question I'm left with is about reconfiguration. If social firewall postures are learned adaptations to specific environments, what happens when the environment changes and you don't? Daniel's childhood family was hostile. His restrictive config made sense there. Is it still optimal in a safe relationship? And his wife's permissive config, if Hilbert's right, that it's an active probe rather than a vulnerability, does that hold in every environment, or are there networks where default, permit, is dangerous? I don't think there's a clean answer. But I think the first step is just knowing what you're running. Most people don't audit their own social firewall. They inherited the rules and never looked at the config file.
The second step is recognizing that your partner's config isn't a broken version of yours. It's a different policy, optimized for a different threat model, written by a different history. The goal isn't to converge on one config. It's to understand both well enough to route traffic intelligently.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the hotel stories and the uncomfortable insight that friendliness might be a better audit tool than suspicion.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own social firewall config or anything else you've been thinking about, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.